are lots of musicians at the
store. You know, as opposed to people who, like, listen to music, were there people who made music hanging around there trying to hear what other people were recording?
Well, they'd be, first of all, those days, the dance band started to work. Across the street was the Commodore Hotel, and running through the Commodore Hotel to play for dancing would be Isham Jones, Tommy Dorsey, Sammy Kaye. Three that I remember. There were more than that. But we're talking about jazz musicians. Isham's man had some marvelous records. The Last Side You Played by Mildred Bailey. Mildred Bailey used to come into the store, too. Blue Prelude. That was written as a closing theme for Isham Jones Orchestra. It was written by Joe Bishop and Gordon Jenkins. Gordon played piano in that band, and Joe Bishop played flugelhorn, I think. And that became the closing theme for Isham Jones Orchestra. His opening theme was I Can't Believe It's True, I think, at the time. And Tommy's band, of course, when it went into the Commodore, had Bud Freeman in it and Dave Tough and Bunny and all those guys. But we were into jazz at that point anyway. And the Lexington Avenue, the Lexington Hotel had... the first Bob Crosby band, the one that came out of Ben Pollock's band. And they went co-op. And, of course, Lombardo was forever at the Roosevelt Hotel. The Biltmore had Whiteman there, and had, and then Gus Arnheim's band went into White's Restaurant on 42nd Street. The bands were playing.
They were
and
around,
the musicians all came in, the Sidemen, the Rangers, the singers.
People come in and say, do you have a record, the record that they're on, without telling you who they were? Just to
I'll tell you a funny story. Although I recognize him, Hoagie Carmichael came into the store, and he asked to hear, Louis's record had come out on Lazy River, and he asked to hear the record. And I had a crank machine, no electric machine. I used to sell the wind-up portables. And I remember playing it on a Columbia portable for him, and he said, gee, that's great. And he told me who he was. And he had had the same tune out on a Victor, the 38,000 series. I don't know if Bix was on that record or not, but I said to him, I said, Hoagie, you know, it's such a great song and all. And he told me how much he liked the Louis record. I says, how come Louis sings the song better than you do? You know, how come his record is so much better? He says, well, that's Louis, you know, and he just loved Louis's record of his song.
Okay, we're going to get that record set up. As we're about to listen to it, let me ask you to tell us a little bit about the session, what your recollections of the session with Hawkins.
Oh, this was when Hawkins came back from France, and he had been away from the U.S. for a number of years. And Leonard Feather came, he's another fellow who's coming to the store. Leonard Feather came into the store and he said, Milt, do you know Hawkins? I said, I never met him. I know all about him, of course, but I had never met him. He said, well, he's back from France and he's opening on 52nd Street. And he had just made Body and Soul for Bluebird. And I said, sure, I want him. So Feather said, well, I'll get him. I know him. And he picked the tunes out. I picked I Surrender Dear because he could do a ballad treatment of it. And I used Roy for the trumpet relief on it, same as I had used Roy and Chew Berry on Body and Soul. And we did I Surrender. Benny Carter was on the session also, but he doesn't play on this because it was strictly Coleman Hawkins and Roy Eldridge.
Okay, let's hear it. This is I Surrender Dear. Let's listen to another one of the sessions that you've brought with you today. And we're going to hear something with Wild Bill Davison. Want to tell us about the session?
Well, this is one of my favorite Commodore sessions, and I think one of the greatest Dixieland-style jazz records ever made. It was the first thing we did after that 1943 recording band when Wild Bill had come to New York. He had been working around town, playing in the Village, playing at Jimmy Ryan's. and got back in with his old friends from Chicago. And this is almost the perfect jazz band, and it happened to come out that way in the recording. And talking about direct-to-disc recording, listen to this session, which was made with one main mic and a mic to open near the piano player in 1943. And the first tune we made after the recording band with Wild Bill Davis, and I love the band so much I call it the Commodores. And it has, I might as well give the personnel, it has Wild Bill, Pee Wee Russell, George Brunis, that great tailgate trombonist, Gene Schroeder on piano, Bob Casey on bass, Eddie Cunningham guitar, and George Wetling, who was the favorite drummer of mine on all this type of Commodore recording. That's a plenty. Listen to it.
Thank you.
Words Aplenty from another Commodore session. My guest, if you're just joining us, is Milt Gabler, who ran the now legendary Commodore Record Shop in Manhattan, and from 1938 to about 1948, produced for his own independent record company, Commodore Records. Many of these sessions are on the verge of reissue via Columbia Special Products, and they will be reissued with their own name, the Commodore Records. One of the reissue recordings that Milt Gabler did with Commodore was a reissued work of Jelly Roll Morton in the, late 1930s? Did you?
He made it in 1939. It was similar to the Library of Congress recordings he did. He did them for General Records, and one day Hazard Reeves, who owned General Records, called me up, and he wanted to sell the company, and I grabbed it because of this album. And I bought all the 78s. And the new LP that's coming out on this, I found two unissued Jelly Roll Morton piano solos. One of his tunes, The Naked Dance, and it's completely different than the one that came out. It's almost like a different song. And Sporting House Rag, which wasn't issued before. So the new album will have 12 cuts in it rather than 10.
Did you get to meet Jelly Roll Morton?
Well, he used to come into the store at the years when he came up to make the General recordings, and he was just like you read about him. He gave me one of his cards, the inventor of jazz, stomps, and swing, and he was a colorful individual. I think he had one tooth with a diamond in it, and he was very nice to talk to and all.
Were the latter years of his life difficult monetarily, you know?
I don't know. He always dressed nicely. He always looked the same, you know, thin. And he didn't stay to chat too long, you know. And he just came in because it was a place for musicians to drop in and let me know they were in town, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I used to get mail for musicians. I used to lend them money out of the till. We have a song called Tapping the Commodore Till. Some days I loaned out more money than I took in, and especially in the 52nd Street store. But we had our mail order business, so it was okay.
We're going to hear one of these Jelly Roll Morton sessions.
Good.
We'll hear Buddy Bolden's Blues. Do you want to say a few words about it before we get to it?
There's nothing much you can say, but it's just a delightful record with Jelly's own inimitable way of singing, and nobody could top him at this kind of thing. It's just piano and voice, and it holds you.
Thought I heard Buddy Bolden say, "You nasty, you dirty, take it away. You're terrible, you're awful. Take it away." I thought I heard him say, I thought I heard Buddy Bolden shout, "Open up that window and let that bad air out. Open up that window, let the foul air out." I thought I heard Buddy Bolden sing. Thought I heard Judge Fogarty say, 30 days in the market, take him away. Get him a good broom to sweep with, take him away." I thought I heard him say. Thought I heard Frankie Dewson shout, "Gal, give me that money, I'm gonna beat it out. I mean, give me that money like I explain you, I'm gonna beat it out." 'Cause I thought I heard Frankie Dewson say. Thank you.
Jelly Roll Morton singing, and at the piano, Buddy Bolden's Blues, one of the sessions on the Commodore record label. We're going to get to hear a little bit of Jack Teagarden next. This is great. I really love to hear Teagarden sing. You got a chance to work with him when you produced the session that we're about to hear. Did you get a sense of what he thought of his own singing? I mean, for me, when I'm looking at a Teagarden record, I'm going to see how many times he sings on it. I mean, really. Well, which isn't to say I don't love his trombone playing.
Well, everybody loves his singing. It's a singing musician, and I always favor them, even if they don't have a lyric voice, you know. They get more flavor into it, and they play it like they play the horn. They sing it like they play the horn. And Teagarden was always a joy to work with, and he got so much respect from all the other men, and he was the king of what he did. And Tommy Dorsey was different, and Jack Jenny was different, but Teagarden was a first and a one of a kind, and a lot of guys imitated him, but there was only one Teagarden. And when he sang, you loved it. And the thing we're going to play, we made in 1944, and it has Maxie Kaminsky on it, who always gives you that good, solid trumpet. And it's from an album of Jack Teagarden and Max Kaminsky. And I think Ernie Caceres played clarinet on this record. He played beautiful clarinet. People generally know him as a baritone sax player. From his big band work. And Norma Teagarden plays piano. It's one of the few recordings she made. And during the session, Wingy Minone dropped in to say hello while we were recording. So we had made one take, which I haven't issued yet, of Teagarden singing Rockin' Chair alone. The tune we're going to hear is Rockin' Chair. But Wingy walked in the studio, and we had him sing the fills that you always hear on Rockin' Chair, like when Louie and Trauma Young did it. And so let's play this Rockin' Chair, one of my favorites.
Rockin' chair's got me.
Oh, rockin' chair got you, Jackson.
In by my side.
In by your side.
Fetch me my gin, son.
I ain't got no gin, father.
For I tend your hide.
Gonna tend my hide, boy.
Can't get from this cabin.
Can't get from this cabin.
Ain't going nowhere.
You ain't going nowhere, oh.
Just sitting here grabbing,
grabbing, grabbing
at the flies around his rocking chair.
Rocking chair, ooh.
My dear old Aunt Harriet.
My Aunt Harriet, too, boy.
How long in heaven she be?
Ain't gonna be long.
Send me a sweet chariot.
And you got it.
For the end of the trouble I see.
I see, Jackson.
Oh, rock and check it.
Oh, rock, check, get it.
Judgment Day is here.
Judgment Day is here, baby.
I'm chained to my old rocking chair.
Rocking chair.
Okay, we just heard Jack Teagarden, recording of Rockin' Chair. If you're just joining us, my guest is Milt Gabler, the man behind the Commodore Record Shop and Commodore Records. He is the producer of the session that we just heard, as well as many other sessions with many other musicians. Many of the Commodore sessions are on the verge of reissue through Columbia Special Products. Milt, before we have to end the show this afternoon, and it's ending a little too soon for my taste, I'd love for you to just, you know, describe to us a little bit what your approach to the reissues that are going to be coming out soon via Columbia Special Products have been to, you know, reworking some of the material that's been out of print.
Well, as I mentioned before, we will have alternate choice masters along with the originals, which gives you two versions on many of the tunes and different solos by the various soloists. And this is something the collectors that write to me have been wanting for a long time, because they always figured I had stuff hidden in my house that they hadn't heard, and it's true. And they'll be coming out, and everything will come out, my hope is, chronologically. In other words, by artist or type. I won't be putting an album out of all trombonists or all clarinetists, and which has been done before, so that when the collector gets the Bud Freeman Trio or Jelly Roll, he has it complete and in order of recording, generally, unless we have to switch them to fit on the two sides of a record. And the idea was to catch them when they were at their peak and record the songs, because a lot of these tunes you don't hear on the air or in rooms, and especially the old-time traditional tunes. And that's why I made them in the 40s, to preserve them, because when the swing era came in, which I always felt the Commodore was kind of responsible for, we had the writers point up that word that was really the same old jazz, but we called it swing music. That band swung. Man, that swings. So we call it swing music. But it's really, and the spirit on these records, the difference in the Commodores and other records contemporary at that time, recorded at that time, is the Commodores had a lot of life to them. We were able to make inspirational recordings because all the musicians loved each other, and they were getting together from different bands, and it wasn't the same old thing every night. It was Teagarden sitting in with Condon, or Freeman coming out of Tommy's band, and these boys had known themselves for many years, and went way back, 10 years earlier they had played together, and it was exciting for them to get together and support each other, and thrill each other all over again. And I would sit there in the booth, and if I didn't like it, I'd say, take another one, it can be better. And then when they had, I'd say, that's it. Sometimes we get it on one take. sometimes on three, sometimes on two. And luckily, I was able to have two takes on a lot of things, because today you record on tape, and when you get it, generally the other performances are wiped out. Or in some studios I work, they roll back in order not to waste tape, and that kills me.
Oh.
That's their policy.
Yeah.
But I saved at least two cuts of everything I made. And that's the way it's coming out, chronologically by artist. Terry, I appreciate it. And I'm very glad to have been able to get here. And as I promise you, I'll come back and we'll do another show.
Oh, I would love it. I would just love it.
There's nothing I love more than talking about my life's work or my life, music.
Oh, that's great. Well, I will look forward to that. Let me just say that Milt Gabler will also be... We're going to be listening to a lot of the records that you've produced on the Commodore record label that are about to be reissued on Columbia Special Products, but
right.
First...
No, I want to clarify that.
Okay.
They're being reissued by Columbia Special Products, but the great old Commodore label is coming back. They'll be called Commodore, and that's a big thing to a lot of collectors and fans. I correspond with people all over the world, and... it seems that even as far away as Japan, they want the Commodore label, that maroon label with the gold lettering, back in circulation again. And that's what Columbia Special Products is doing. They're putting out Commodore.
Well, both your label and the Commodore record shop have become legends in jazz. So I'd like to go back to 1926 when you started at the shop. How did you get there?
Well, actually... the store was a radio and electrical store called the Commodore Radio Shop, the 42nd Street store. The original radio shop was at 144 East 42nd, a little 9-foot store. And I worked there after school. I purposely went to Stuyvesant High School from the Bronx to be near my dad's radio shop, because I had to work there after school. I would do my homework in the back and wait on customers or run errands, whatever. And we used to play a loudspeaker outside the door to attract passers-by, you know, to let them know that there was a radio shop there. But I would always keep popular music on the speaker, and people came in and said, "Do you sell phonograph records?" Well, it didn't take me long to realize that we should have phonograph records in the shop, not just radio parts for hams and little radio sets, etc. So I told my father that we ought to take in records. So he said, "I don't know anything about music." I said, "I know everything about music. I know every song there is," like any teenager would tell his dad. And he said, "Well, you call up Columbia and Victor or somebody and get a salesman here, see what it takes to sell records." And I called Columbia and Brunswick. I couldn't get RCA Victor. They used to have restricted agencies in those days, just like automobile dealers probably have today. And I got Victor's a couple of years later, but I had Columbia and Harmony, and I got in Perfect Four for Dollar Records and Harmony Records and OK Records, and I was happy. I was selling popular music.
The store not only was a store, but it was a hangout from what I know about it. People used to just come there and listen, I guess, and meet with other people, too.
Well, that happened years later. In the beginning, in 1926, I didn't know anything about jazz, although I used to like hot music, what I called hot music. My favorite things as a young man were, the St. Louis Blues had come out, and that was a big smash song. And I never forget, it was before we sold records, just before. I think St. Louis Blues came out in 1926, and it might just be coincidental that I took in records about that time. But I went to a record shop on East 42nd Street near 2nd Avenue. We were between 3rd and Lex. That was where the Victor dealer was. And I went in there, and I asked for a record of the St. Louis Blues, because I was crazy about the song. And he said, "I have one by Paul Whiteman." I said, "Terrific, I'll take it," because Whiteman was a big name in those years. And I took the record home, and played it, and I was very disappointed in the recording of it. It was too concertized. It didn't sound the way I like to hear the St. Louis Blues when I went to a dance or something. And I went back, and I got the Ted Lewis record of it, which is the way I wanted it played, which was like a Dixieland jazz band record. And it shows you that even in those days, you could buy a wrong record just by buying it by title with a good name on it if you didn't hear it on the air. Today you would hear it on the air or in a jukebox. But I even at 15 years of age had a preference for the way the music was played, and I didn't like the big band arrangement of it.
And you tried to create an environment within the shop, I guess, so that people could hear what the music was.
That came about all by itself because of the types of records that I sold and specialized in. I don't think it took until probably 1932 or 33 before there were any hot fans coming into the store. In the beginning, I just sold whatever popular records came out. You know, if it was Get Out and Get Under the Moon, I would sell that by Ben Selvin or whoever recorded it. And the salesman would come in with the titles of the week's releases, and I would pick them out. I remember I used to, in those days, they put the writers under the titles of the songs, so I would notice which ones were by Gershwin or Irving Berlin, and you'd get to know that those were better songs, generally. And so you learned about the composers also. But I didn't know who played on a record or anything. Of course, you knew that the advertised and popular bands like Ted Lewis and Paul Whiteman. But it wasn't considered jazz to me. You know, actually, in the old days, when the good old songs that are the standards today came out in the middle 20s and the late 20s, when you heard them by a small band, it was a kind of a jazz band. It wasn't arranged, and it was really played for dancing. Nobody looked at it as a jazz record. It was only when you got into the 30s and you began to pick out soloists and records that started to swing a little bit, and you started to learn about Louis and King Oliver and Duke Ellington, that you started to, although in the old days we didn't think Duke Ellington could swing.
Really?
Yeah. No. We didn't use the word swing in the early days, and I'll get to that later, how when we formed the Hot Club, we actually promoted the word swing to like it was a new kind of music in order to get space in magazines and newspapers for the jazz musicians to get more work because they were playing swing.
Well, Milt Gaylor, before we talk some more about your shop, I'm really anxious for our listeners to get a taste of some of the music that you recorded. So let's listen to what was, I guess, the first record that you made for the Commodore record label, for your record label.
Right.
Want to tell us a little bit about it?
Well, I had been reissuing a jazz record. Now you're up to 1938.
We're going to go back again, but I just want everyone just to get a little taste of it.
This was the first session I did. Eddie Condon used to be a habitué of the Commodore Music Shop. That time it was no more Radio Shop. And he had been coming in for quite a number of years at that point. And, of course, the bands in Greenwich Village and on 52nd Street by 1938, the big bands were here too, the bands like Benny Goodman and all, and Tommy and everybody. And what happened was, from about 1933 or 4, I reissued my first record, and this is now 4 years later. We had formed a jazz club called the United Hot Clubs of America. The New York branch was called the New York Hot Club of New York. And I used to run jazz concerts at the record studios and get the press there to publicize jazz music. And I reissued all the gems that the big companies had discontinued selling. I would order enough for them to press it for me. And by 1938, or 37 to 38, the market had been created for jazz collecting and jazz music. And John Hammond was hired by Columbia to reissue their great catalog, which I had been using as well as Jeanette's and stuff like that. and I could see the handwriting on the wall because our reissue sold for a dollar, and even some were even a dollar and a half. I had to make new masters and things. And they were going to put them out. They reduced the price of the records to 50 cents. And I said, well, if they're going to sell them for 50 cents, I better stop making $1 records of similar things. And so I said, I better make records that they can't stop me from selling and I'll have exclusively. And I got a hold of Eddie and I said, let's get some of our favorite guys together and try and recreate the stuff you did like you were young, when you were younger in Chicago. I really wanted to get a sound like the Chicago Rhythm Kings. I found a new baby, and there'll be some changes made. But the men, of course, by 1938, 10 years later, were more proficient with their horns. They were better musicians. They had been used to jamming more, and when I got them together, it didn't come out like the Chicago Rhythm Kings records, but it came out the way you're going to hear it now. Let's play Love Is Just Around the Corner, the first one I ever cut.
Eddie Condon, and what we just heard was the first session that Milt Gabler recorded for his Commodore record label. As he explained, he had done some reissues before that, but this was the first session that he produced himself. Do you want to tell us who else was playing on that session?
You have Bobby Hackett, Pee Wee, George Brunus, Bud Freeman, Jess Stacy on piano, George Wetling on drums, Artie Shapiro on bass, and who did I leave out? Eddie Condon guitar. And it was difficult to get this session recorded. I had tried to record it about 6 months earlier, and Freeman and Wetling and Jess were in the big bands. And one was with Tommy Dorsey, one was with Benny Goodman, and the other one was with Red Norvo. And the bands travel, and I had to get this band together. I had to do it when everyone was in town. And the other fellows, the bass player, Artie, was working with Joe Marsala at the Hickory House, but Bobby Hackett, Pee Wee, and George Brunis were at Nick's down in the Village, the old Nick's, across from 10th Street. And they all evidently came in town for the Benny Goodman concert. And this session was made the day after the Benny Goodman famous Carnegie Hall concert. And two of the titles of the blues I did were Carnegie Drag and Carnegie Jump to commemorate the concert of Benny Goodman at Carnegie Hall. In fact, Benny gave me permission to use Jess on the Commodore date on Monday, and he canceled his date at Victor.
Why don't we hear another selection from that same session?
The next one I have lined up for is the session after this one, and it's the same band but with Jack Teagarden on trombone, and it's the famous version, the original version of Embraceable You, which made Bobby Hackett a famous cornetist, and it's his interpretation of it. And I think there's a Pee Wee and a Freeman solo on it also. And it was made after it. Eddie got me to do the session a few months after the other one. I didn't have all the records released yet on 78 of the first session. And we were able to get a Life magazine story on a Commodore recording session. Well, Life magazine at that time was not in Radio City. It was across the street from the Commodore Music Shop.
Right.
In the Chrysler Building. The Loose Publications were there, and all the writers used to hang out in the store at lunchtime and play records. And so we got this jazz essay. It became a 14-page essay on jazz in Life magazine. Originally, we were supposed to have Pee Wee Russell on the cover, but King Edward abdicated, and we didn't get on the front cover. And they took away space, and the jazz story didn't run till about a month or so later, in the middle of the summer, with some divers going off of a cliff, and Pee Wee's great face was inside within the jazz story. So, and it was about swing and jazz, and I had a list of 30 suggested records to start a jazz hot collection. We call it a hot collection with. And right after that, we sold so many hot records that I opened the store on 52nd Street. But let's play Embraceable You, featuring Bobby Hackett.